Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola and very excited to be joined by two guests today. First up, Ryan Grimm. Welcome back.
That's good to be back.
Glad to have you here. Ryan, of course, both The Intercept and also a contributor to TYT. Also the author of a book that's available right now at Shop TYT. That's We've Got People. Ryan, can you tell people who might not be familiar with the book about, you know, what it delves into?
Yeah, it's basically your progressive primer. It's like a history of the progressive insurgent movement going from basically the 1980s, you know, really zeroing in on Jesse Jackson's campaign and drawing a line straight from there up to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Bernie Sanders campaign of 2020. So it's basically the establishment insurgent fight drawn out over the last 30 years. But yeah, support TYT. Get it at their store.
Awesome. You know, I'm curious, around when did you finish? When was the book locked, basically, for publication?
Like May of 2020.
Okay.
I've been able to update it a little bit since then.
Okay, yeah, because there seems like some obvious, like, maybe the second edition can have a bit of a follow-up, like, so where exactly did we go 6 months after the primary ended?
Yeah, what happened to those people? Yeah,
exactly. No, I think it's gonna be awesome. And definitely if you're looking to sort of get an idea of where we've come from, where we might be going, everybody go take a look at the book. It's available, you know, at the places books are sold as well as Shop TYT, which is generally where t-shirts are sold.
I said May of 2020. I meant May of 2019.
Okay. I gotcha. Right. Okay. So it was a bit before we knew exactly what was going to end up happening.
Right.
But that's awesome. And then thank you for joining us on the show today. Very excited to have you on. Ryan and I are going to be talking about a couple of stories. And in this first one, which we're going to transition to in just a minute, we might get a bit of a preview of some of the work that Ryan is engaged in right now. So if you're in the chat right now, which it looks like a good number of you are, please hit the like button, subscribe, and hit the bell so you get notifications in the future. Every stream, 5 minutes before we end, I get a notification from someone saying, "Hey, I didn't even know this was going on." Well, there's only one way you can do that, and that's by hitting the bell. So with that, Ryan, why don't we jump into the first story? For some time now, we've been talking about the number of generally senators, but also representatives, who appear to have used their early access to information about how bad coronavirus was likely to be in the United States to save themselves a little bit of money, either purchasing stocks that seemed likely to go up in the event of a pandemic or selling off stocks before the stock market tanked. And one of the names that showed up the most early on in that was Richard Burr, who had sold quite a bit of stock. It looks like anywhere between a bit more than $500,000 or almost $2 million in one day as he was getting confidential information about the potential spread of coronavirus. And he said along the way, he didn't know anything. It wasn't him. He's not responsible, all of that. But there's some new information coming out that's making that a little bit harder to believe. Particularly that Senator Richard Burr's brother-in-law, Gerald Fouth, who was a post on the National Mediation Board, apparently sold between $97,000 and $280,000 worth of shares in six companies, including several that have been hit particularly hard in the market swoon and economic downturn. And he apparently did that on the same day that Richard Burr decided to, totally coincidentally, sell off a bunch of his stock. So we have other elements of this story we're going to get to, but Ryan, I'm interested in your take on this. How bad is this for Fouth and for Burr?
Well, Burr is retiring, so you could see Burr's mind working. You know, let's be clear. He says that he was selling his stocks based on reading the news coming out of Asia in particular. And you know what? Like, that's quite plausible. Like, there were a lot of people who were publicly saying, look, like, this is going to be a pandemic. This is going to be very bad. So a halfway intelligent person who was following this could have seen a stock collapse coming. That it happened on the same day certainly raises eyebrows. And now that we know that his brother-in-law sold on the same day, you know, the coincidences are starting to stack up. And you can imagine Burr's retiring. He's not he's rich, but by Senate standards, he's not rich. Now he's set to get very rich once he leaves the Senate. You know, there are lucrative opportunities for people with his connections. But what it's most damaging for isn't necessarily him, unless they actually to prosecute him, then he's got serious problems. But for Republicans in North Carolina, because it rubs off on Tom Tillis, who is up for re-election this cycle and is by polling the least popular incumbent senator in his or her home state across the country. He's now behind almost by double digits, mm-hmm. To a fairly kind of B-level candidate that Democrats have put up in North Carolina named Cal Cunningham, you know, fairly standard blue dog-ish type of Democrat who doesn't have much of a political background. I think he served maybe a term in the state house or something. But he's getting smoked right now in the polls by Cunningham. And the more that Burr is in the news for trading in advance of this collapse, I think the worse it is for Tillis and for Republicans generally in the state of North Carolina, and even for Trump in North Carolina. You know, if the state, you know, swings far enough, then he could potentially lose it if the, you know, the suburbs around Raleigh and the Durham area, et cetera, all swing against him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I saw a poll just a few days ago where Biden was up by 4, I think, something like that. I mean, obviously, these are polls that are, it's a long way away, and who right. knows. But yeah, it's a good point. It being in the news could hurt them. So you know what we're going to talk about for a few more minutes. So I do want to give a response from Senator Burr's attorney. This is Alice Fisher, who told ProPublica, which did this reporting on Gerald Fouth, said that, quote, Senator Burr participated in the stock market based on public information, and he did not coordinate his decision to trade on February 13th with Mr. Fouth. She did not respond to a question about whether Burr discussed anything he learned as a senator with Fouth or any other relatives. Maybe she was just busy. I don't know. She just didn't right. have time to respond to that. Okay, so as you said, it is plausible that if you were following everything that was happening in China and as it started to spread to other countries in the region, and apparently it was spreading worldwide, it just wasn't immediately clear at that point, that you could behave in the way that Senator Burr and others did. But the problem is always going to be he was also getting confidential information. He was putting out statements reassuring everyone that Donald Trump has got this thing as he was acting as if he believed the opposite. And so whether it's obviously not illegal, they're disputing right. whether it's unethical, but to regular people, it is going to seem incredibly shady that you have access to private information and public information, and you claim that the emergency economic moves that you made were based purely on the one and not the other. Why would we believe that, honestly? And that's right. why I approve of people like AOC who are saying they shouldn't be owning individual stocks. At the very least, it should be in blind trusts.
And although it actually would be illegal if they could prove that he made the trade based on private information that he got from that briefing, because there is now a law that says that if you cannot trade, you can trade stocks, but you can't trade stocks based on information that you received through your duties as a senator. So, you know, if they can connect that private briefing that he got to some of the trades, if there are emails or texts, to his sister or to anywhere else, to his broker, saying this, you know, as he's coming out of that meeting, this is going to be really bad, you know, sell. Then potentially that actually is illegal. But AOC's point is dead on here. It's absurd that members of Congress can own individual stocks and then legislate and regulate and lawmake, or, you know, in areas that affect the stock prices. You know, David Perdue, for instance, has been wrapped up in this scandal. He's the senior senator from Georgia. Kelly Loeffler is the junior senator from Georgia. Both of them have been caught up in it because both sold a bunch of stocks at the time, you know, February and March, you know, January, and these key moments. Now, some of Perdue's trades are, to me, actually mitigating of the fact that he was purely selling because of the you know, insider information about the coming pandemic. Particularly, he bought shares in Delta, the local, you know, the Atlanta-based airline.
Okay.
And if you were trying to profit off of the coming pandemic, Delta is the, you know, an airline is the last place that you would put money. So that does suggest to me that either he was making some trades without thinking about the pandemic, or his advisor was making them on his behalf without any information on that. But then you take it another level further. Congress is debating whether or not to bail out the airline industry, how to bail out the airline industry. And here's this senator sitting with a bunch of stock in an airline. It's just absurd. Like, yeah, there's no ethical guidelines that you could draw that would allow that type of thing, just from a pure ethics standpoint. Why these extremely wealthy members of the Senate don't put their money into a blind trust is, I was going to say, it's beyond me, but it's because they haven't really suffered a penalty for it in the past. If Loeffler and Perdue go down, you're going to see a lot more wealthy senators move toward blind trusts. Mm-hmm. Dianne Feinstein has a blind trust, and so she's extremely wealthy. But she doesn't get hit for these types of trades because she can say, look, here's the legal paperwork that says I have no idea what my financial advisors are doing with my money. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have that much money, you know, that you can not even worry about it. So, you know, the Republican operatives are, upset with people like Perdue and Loeffler, who set themselves up for a political reckoning by not doing this. And it also creates an uncomfortable conversation in the midst of a terrible economy. So both of them are running for reelection with more than 30 million people unemployed around the country. And there's all this talk about how they have tens of millions of dollars to throw around in exactly. the stock market, which just, everyone knows that Republicans are the party of the rich, but that just underscores it in a way that's just in your face.
Exactly. Yeah, no, the point that you made about Delta, that is certainly interesting. To balance it out, let's also remember, though, that he apparently bought shares in a company that produces PPE on the same day he received a classified briefing on the spread of the coronavirus. So,
yeah, that was DuPont. And if you wanted to be devil's advocate for him, you'd say, well, DuPont makes everything.
They make a lot of things. Yes, that is true. Right. That is
right.
true.
But he also unloaded a ton of casino shares. Mm-hmm. So that was a well-timed trade because, casinos absolutely, were eviscerated by the quarantine.
Yeah. Las Vegas is trying to open up, though.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Great story out today on The Intercept by Ida Chavez about how some state governments appear to be sort of preemptively working with companies to track down those employees who might refuse to come back to work when their economy is reopened, even when many medical experts are saying that there's still a lot of reason to believe that the threat of COVID-19 is not substantially decreased, and these workers are justifiably worried about being exposed to it. So I want to read just a few excerpts from the article, which is available right now on The Intercept. There's now a form on the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services website for employers to confidentially report employees, quote, who quit or refuse work when it is available due to COVID-19, flagging them program for the state's Office of Unemployment Insurance Operations. As of right now, Ohioans who are unemployed as a result of the pandemic but don't qualify for regular unemployment benefits can also register for a new federal unemployment program, Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. This includes coverage for individuals whose doctors have advised staying home and for those who have childcare duties, but so far, employees aren't protected if they're afraid of catching the virus at work, which, of course, many of them will be. And this system seems to be set up in a way that the government will be able to be told anonymously which employees are refusing to come to work for other reasons and which are just afraid of, you know, exposing themselves or their families to a fatal pathogen to potentially cause them to not have access to the special unemployment fund.
Yeah, they're using the threat of the law and of economic misery to try to force people into what they consider unsafe conditions. It's blunt, it's direct, it's done in, as you saw, it's done in collusion with employers. You know, the forum promises, you know, strict confidentiality between, you know, the bosses and the government, so that employees don't come back and say, wait, you turned me in to the state after I told you that, you know, my mother and my grandmother are both living with me, and so I was nervous about infecting them with coronavirus. And, you know, there's more than 30 plus million people unemployed, many of whom mm-hmm. are looking for work. Let those folks have those jobs if they want it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. By the way, I'm seeing in the comments people are saying that today TDR stands for the Darling Report. And someone said that's the next generation of TYT reporters. You never know. Maybe New York Times, maybe Washington Post. So hello, kids. So I wanted to add, by the way, that when, you know, if you're not in Ohio right now and you're trying to get an idea of how reasonable is it that these employees are worried about being exposed to COVID-19, as of when I checked this morning, Ohio so far has had 21,576 cases of coronavirus. God only knows how many they actually have, but that's the number of confirmed, and over 1,200 deaths already. And, you know, and so they're very worried. And by the way, like, put it in the context of what other states are doing as well, I saw reporting this morning that the Hillstone Restaurant Group in Texas told their employees, you are not allowed to wear a mask or any sort of facial covering, potentially because they're worried about sending the signal that things are not safe, even though by doing that you are making things less safe. And they told their employees that they're going to be offered 40-hour schedules right now, and if they refuse them, they will not be eligible to be rehired at a later date. Like, you come back now and disarm yourself against the virus or potentially lose your job forever.
Right, and Ohio is one of the states that has behaved more responsibly than any others. They shut down earlier than most states. The Republican governor, Mike DeWine, suspended the presidential campaign the primary election there, while other states recklessly went forward. But this shows that a lot of the public health concern, you know, stops at a certain class level.
Yeah.
In this country, and that, you know, when there's a competition or a conflict between the upper class, ruling class, having people serve them, and the public health of the people doing the serving, you know, it's going to be the upper class that wins out.
Yeah, it's looking that way, and you know, we're sort of waiting to see. We had the reopening of a few states this last Friday and the Friday before that. And so, you know, in 5 days, in 10 days, we might begin to see the initial spike that comes from that reopening, assuming that the testing is even being done to the extent that we'll be able to find it. And I hate the situation that these employees have been put in, where they're being put out of work, and most of what they're hearing on right-wing media is, we want to reopen. We don't care if it's dangerous. And we want that because we care about these people who are out of work and they're losing money. And that's what they're saying. They're never saying the government needs to provide aid to them. The government needs to send out an additional check. The government needs to do anything. It's that potential set of solutions is 100% ignored. The only way to help these people that they swear they're worried about is to send them into the breach. Call them warriors, disarm them, and send them in to potentially die.
It is true that people are suffering economically through this. There's absolutely no question about that, and that should be foremost in politicians' minds. But like you said, the answer to that is to take care of those people. We are asking them to stay home, to protect and to benefit the public, so the public can take care in return of those people. The answer is not, like you said, to throw them into the mall.
Just a few days ago, there was an attempted coup against the government of Venezuela. I say coup, maybe it's coup, I don't know, because the entire thing seems a little bit laughable. I mean, not in some senses, people lost their lives, and it was an attempt to overthrow the government of a country, and apparently the U.S. wasn't directly involved. We'll get into that. We're going to have all the details. The story's been out for a few days, but, you know, Nando, I especially wanted to talk about this with you because I was curious, have you been predicting this for some time now?
Oh, yes. This was inevitable. I mean, there was an attempted coup last year in 2019 when a bunch of kind of Venezuelan military people loyal to Juan Guaido, who's a leader of the opposition, sort of attempted to rise up and topple Maduro, but it also crashed and burned mm-hmm. in farcical fashion. But at the time, you know, a lot of countries recognized the Guaido government as the quote-unquote legitimate government of Venezuela. So it's only a matter of time before they gave it another shot. And this one is just particularly hilarious. Like, it really does feel like a very 2020 story uh-huh. in that it's just the sheer incompetence and farcical nature of it is very much something that is true to our time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically like a private security contractor who is an American military guy. He was a medic in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Started this private security company, got in contact with some former Venezuelan military guys who are running these training camps in the Colombian desert near the Venezuelan border, and were under the leadership of this kind of old Venezuelan major general who has since been arrested and indicted in New York on drug trafficking charges. You know? Wow. And so what they basically trained a group of a few hundred men to basically invade Venezuela and topple the government. I mean, it's just you hear something like this and you're like, what were they thinking, you know? Mm-hmm. And it just seems like everyone they came in contact with, from some of Trump's personal security guards to leaders of the Venezuelan opposition in Miami, like this guy that runs an arms company out of Miami, who's a Venezuelan dissident, you know, everyone who just like got a whiff of these guys was like, no, I don't want anything to do with you. Yeah. And they went ahead anyway. They were like, you know, it's, you know what it reminds me of? It's kind of like the fire fest of coup attempts.
Of coup attempts?
Yeah, where they're like, F it, let's be legends. Let's just do it.
Is it like, you know, they say that our entire culture now is reboots. Is this just like the Bay of Pigs, but like with less of a chance of success?
It really, like, the Bay of Pigs absolutely had a greater chance of success than this thing, because at least the Bay of Pigs, the upper echelons of the U.S. government were actively involved. Like, the CIA was actively involved, and mm-hmm. John Kennedy knew about it. The president knew about it.
Yeah.
This seems like they were trying to get in touch with people in the Trump administration, and even the Trump administration was like, no, I don't really want anything to do with you guys.
Yeah, and look, so. I it seems so farcical. Like, it sounds like the plot of a movie like on Netflix starring Adam Sandler or something like that. It's obviously incredibly serious, and so I yeah. feel sort of bad for laughing about it. Like, people lost their lives. What they were attempting to do was incredibly serious. It seems so 2020. Like, yeah. it was 60 people in like little speedboats with 50 additional. The Venezuelan military has 130,000 active duty soldiers and another 220,000 paramilitary loyalists. That yeah. is about as big as world militaries are.
Yeah, it's one of the most heavily armed countries in the world. Like, I mean, that's always been the real tragedy about the situation in Venezuela, is that there's a very real chance of some sort of civil conflict happening. Mm-hmm. And if that were the case, it would be unbelievably violent, because it's just, there's just a lot of weapons lying around in Venezuela.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people are armed. It wouldn't be just a kind of little skirmish between two militias. Like, there's hundreds of thousands of armed people in Venezuela, like ready to fight. So it would be unbelievably bloody. And like you said, this is a very serious situation in many ways. And it, you know, it fits a long-term pattern. I mean, the United States and the CIA supported a coup attempt on Hugo Chavez in 2002 in Venezuela. They actively and vocally supported the 2019 coup attempt through John Bolton and even Trump, and they even recognized the government. So, you know, this is part of an ongoing long-term pattern. And it just, the real tragedy is that it on the one hand, you know, like no one loves the Maduro regime. Like there's no love for the Maduro regime, but the Maduro regime has a point.
Yeah, really fast. You don't have to say that, but at the same time in 2020, you sort of have to acknowledge that.
Obviously. Yeah. If not, you're like an Assadist or a Maduro lover or something, you know, it's like, you know, when he says, like, listen, we're struggling because of U.S. sanctions and because we're constantly under siege by the most powerful nation in the history of the world, you know, he's got a point. Mm-hmm. Like, how can you operate a country in any sort of sane way while you are literally under attack by a country like the United States?
Yeah.
So,
and so we're going to turn in just a second to the potential U.S. involvement. But really fast, I just want to add a couple extra details for potentially signs this wasn't going to result in these 60 people occupying the royal palace and ruling. One was that they live tweeted the raid. Great idea. They apparently had an airsoft gun. Now, they didn't just have airsoft guns, but they had an airsoft gun.
Right.
And one of the organizers of the raid apparently seems to be a big devotee of the QAnon conspiracy theory, which doesn't necessarily say anything, but also at the same time kind of says some things.
Yeah. No, the Silver Corp, this is the company, that the private security company that this guy was founded. They have an Instagram account, and it is one of the funniest things you could ever
see. That
John, as soon as this broadcast ends, just fire up the Instagram and look up the Silver Corp Instagram account. Like, it'll be a picture, like a selfie of the guy, you know, in as the sun's setting, and he'll be like, you know, the golden hour, and then like hashtag tactical training, hashtag live shooter training, hashtag like it's truly, stuff like that. It's truly spectacular. Like the capture, like it's just the whole thing feels so modern in so many ways.
Wait,
it's just great. There you go.
Just don't overthrow governments. It seems like a basic rule. It's not one of the commandments, but like arguably should be.
This is why I hesitate to be like, oh, this so-and-so foreign person is so bad. Because like what flows from that is this instinct to do something about it. Like if that person's so bad, you know, we have to do something about it. So there is like a sometimes like, oh, look at all the suffering. We should do something. But what ends up happening is always the same thing. And you go to war with the military machine you got. And we got the United States military machine. And that is more like a blunt instrument that just shatters like whatever's in its way. It's not like this surgical thing that can achieve sort of narrow goals. Like it usually destabilizes an entire region, usually a lot of people die, and usually it ends up worse than previous.
Like they say, you know, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Well, when the only tool you have is the most bloated, overfunded military in the history of our civilization, every problem looks like you should bomb it, I guess. I don't. Yeah. The metaphor falls apart, and so does the country that we inflict this on. Was the U.S. involved in this attempted overthrow of the government of Venezuela? We don't know for sure, but we do have a little bit of contextual information. We had Mike Pompeo, who said, as for who bankrolled it, we're not prepared to share any more information about what we know took place. We'll unpack that at an appropriate time. We'll share that information that makes good sense. That's a very careful way of saying that. Really
fast. Instead of just being like, no, we don't have nothing to do with this insane thing. You know, like how easy would that be if that were true?
It seems like it.
There was no U.S. government direct involvement in this operation. If we'd have been involved, it would have gone differently.
Okay, so he did not, really fast, he did not say there was no U.S. involvement in this. He said there was no U.S. direct involvement in this. Well, that says basically everything.
Well, that was the whole appeal of the Bay of Pigs in the original kind of version of this TV season. You know, like the plausible deniability of using kind of expats rather than regular American forces was part of the appeal. So like, if it goes wrong, you can just be like, no, that wasn't us. If it goes right,
yeah,
they could have claimed credit.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder, will we find out more about this? I mean, we know that there have been connections between Silvercorp and, like, they'd done private security for Trump before. Like, one of the individuals involved in the raid is photographed, like, providing personal security. That doesn't necessarily mean anything except that our government is buffoonish and the people that they give contracts to. But I wonder, will there be an investigation? Will there be any desire to find out? Because unfortunately, so many people in the Senate, do they really want to discover what's going on and potentially make it look bad and forestall future attempts to interfere with the regime? I don't know.
You mentioned the Senate, and I've been listening to a podcast called Fiasco about the Iran-Contra affair, mm-hmm. and it's just wild to look back at that time and see Senate Democrats like very aggressively investigating the administration and voting to stop funding to the Contras in this kind of insane attempt that they were doing. Like, that is so unthinkable these days for the Senate to do something like that. But they could, but they won't. I suspect that if we find anything out about it, it'll be through reporting from journalists. But,
yeah,
you know, it's one of those things where it fits the larger U.S. strategic goals. And I'm sure some elements of the U.S. state were aware of this and were just kind of like, yeah, fine, go ahead. Like, they're not going to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like this was a plan that was hatched at the highest levels, I don't think.
It doesn't seem like it.
Doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, for their sake, you'd hope not. And really fast, just a little bit more on sort of the monetary aspect of this, because when you see the details and how unlikely it was to actually succeed, it makes you wonder, well, first of all, why did anyone think? Like, the people who got involved in it, like, and people lost their lives. People died. Why?
Yeah, people died.
Why would you think that this could work? Well, there's two potential monetary explanations. One is that Jordan Goodreau, the ex-Green Beret who recruited and organized it, apparently said that he had a contract with Guaido or something. Like, I haven't seen any evidence that it actually exists, but that's what was out there. And then you also have this. Just a few weeks ago, on March 26, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo promised very big rewards for information leading to the arrest and or conviction of the top people in a Venezuelan regime that the United States no longer recognizes. $15 million for Maduro, $10 million each for four of his top officials, all charged by Washington with drug trafficking. Now, that is not saying it's a bounty, hand us Maduro, you get $15 million. But also, what is information leading to his arrest? Like, he's in Venezuela, pay me.
Yeah.
I don't know. What is that information?
He's in the capital. He's got a house. They know where he lives. They know where the government is. Like, this
so it
is,
seems like a wink and a nod to,
yeah,
if you can bring him in, maybe if you get 50 people who definitely can't occupy a country, but maybe could kidnap someone?
Or assassinate him.
Or assassinate, you know, like, yeah, that's true as well. The entire thing, again, very 2020, very unfortunate, and as you pointed out, not the first time, potentially not the last time.
I doubt it will be the last time.
For some time, Donald Trump has been sending signals that the slavish devotion of most of the hosts on Fox News is not enough these days, and he's looking for something new. Anytime someone, you know, Shep Smith or Chris Wallace criticizes him, he will tweet knee-jerk that he wants a different channel. And sometimes he'll credit one in particular, and that is OANN. And recently he alluded again to this desire for a new right-wing channel, tweeting, Chris Wallace is nastier to Republicans than even Deface the Nation or Sleepy Eyes. The people who are watching Fox News in record numbers, thank you, President Trump, are angry. They want an alternative now. So do I. And then he turned to crediting OANN, saying, I hate to be promoting AT&T, but OANN is great news, not fake news. Everybody should be carrying them. So why is this important? Why is this in the news now? Well, apparently, although it's disputed, some in the Trump family are apparently looking to get involved with OANN. According to sources, this was reported by Vanity Fair, an investor group aligned with Don Jr. and the Dallas-based Hicks family has acquired a major stake in One America News Network. Sources said the deal has been dragging on for months and hasn't yet closed, apparently over question of how much it's worth. The leadership of OANN says they want $300 million. I've looked at their production value. I think it's overvalued at $300 million, but that's what they want. Nando, we don't know for sure, and I've got the responses from some of these parties saying it's not totally true, but what do you think about the possibility that OANN could become a competitor to Fox News and that the Trump family might become involved with it.
Well, I remember back in 2016, before Trump won the election, when everyone assumed he was going to lose the election and everyone was like, well, why is he doing this? It was kind of a common knowledge that what he was really interested in was using the presidential race as a platform to launch some sort of media mm-hmm. entity. You know, that he likes the media, he likes being involved in the media, and that he wanted to have his own TV network. So that has always been in the cards.
Yeah.
I think I would not be surprised if they do actually do this, like if they do actually pull it off, I would not be surprised if they actually gave Fox News a run for their money. I mean, the reason why this, like you said, the network has like terrible production values, but what they're really paying for is distribution. I mean, that's the name of the game in cable. I mean, that's, you know, this is a channel. I mean, any channel could be just like changed, but like the distribution is the hard part to get. Mm-hmm. So if they do get distribution, which I'm guessing as the former president, he probably would. I could see them giving Trump. I could see them giving Fox News a run for the money. I mean, they love Trump. The Republicans love him. They love him. They don't like, you know, these like never Trump idiots. You know what I mean? They mm-hmm. love Trump. He's got like a super high approval rating amongst Republican voters.
That's true.
If he figures out that he could outflank Fox from the right, I would not be surprised if people went with it.
Yeah, and look, right now, they apparently are distributed to 35 million homes, which is amazing. Now, that's about a third of what Fox News has, but considering that it seems like a joke, that's a lot. They are really out there. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the fact that it's a news channel, but that just openly, it's just conspiracy theories and absolute not. No, it's Pizzagate, and it's mildly more rational than InfoWars. Is that going to hurt them? Why would it?
No. What? Absolutely like, not.
Why would that possibly hurt? Like, people, like, Fox is bound by the fact that they are very supportive of Donald Trump, but they will occasionally, some of their hosts will criticize him. OANN is not going to do that. They've tweeted at him that we're your biggest supporters. And, like, I understand that some people would think, well, but the right always criticizes MSNBC for being biased. Don't they want unbiased news? No. No, they don't want that. And so that no doesn't one, seem like it's going to hurt.
The sad reality, John, is no one wants that.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. It's just like Diamond and Silk were just fired from Fox News. Like, okay, they're probably going to have a show on OANN. OANN is where Tommy Lauren comes from initially.
Yeah. No, it's, again, like, I think people love Fox, and the real driver of Fox is the sort of more insane like red meat stuff. Like the other kind of more sober serious people on Fox are just kind of like eating your vegetables and like before you eat your ice cream. Like if they could have ice cream all the time, I could see it doing really well. It's just funny because I looked up when we were doing this story, I looked up who owns OANN, and it's this company called Herring Networks, and they own this other cable channel called AWE, which stands for Wealth of Entertainment. But previously that channel was called Wealth TV. Which is just
that's
amazingly
perfect.
Trumpian. Yeah, it's perfect.
That is perfect. Really fast, I want to go to a little bit of a video of Donald Trump's recent obsession with calling on OANN, because even though, you know, they're promoting Pizzagate and everything, they have reporters in the White House press corps.
Okay, a couple of questions. Go ahead, OAN. We'll take a few questions. Emerald. OAN. OAN, please. OAN. 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 OAN.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Thank you very much.
They treat me very nice. And tone as the female reporter starts to talk. Oh,
yeah.
We know what that is.
And he keeps on calling it OAN, but isn't it OANN?
I know. I've heard it called both. It is literally OANN, which is why that's what I'm calling it. But
right.
I don't know. It's one letter more than most networks tend to have, I guess.
Right.
But anyway, and really fast, we should acknowledge that a spokesperson for Don Jr. says that this isn't true. Robert Herring, who is the founder of OANN, says that they don't know anything about Trump Jr. buying the company, and they're not anxious to sell. But of course, if they are trying to sell, they're going to say that they're not anxious to sell. So who knows? I mean, this could amount to absolutely nothing. That's totally possible. It could also amount to, in August, Donald Trump having a show he hosts. as president. That seems crazy, but like, are you going to bet all of your money that that won't happen, that he won't have a show that he co-hosts with Tommy Lahren? Something like that.
No, I would 100%. That is a definitely a plausible scenario. That did not discount that.
Yeah. I just saw this going around this morning, apparently filmed by an employee at a Publix supermarket in Miami. It features an individual apparently quite frustrated with their policy of requiring masks, and he goes on a quite deranged rant against them. Take a look.
This is a false flag pandemic. You are in violation of my constitutional rights and my civil rights.
I've already
warned you. Expect it. I'm filing a class action lawsuit. You can take your fake global terroristic false flag attack, shove it up your You're terrorists. You're in violation of my constitutional and civil rights. There's no pandemic. I'm filing a lawsuit. I have a right to buy groceries without being forced to participate in terrorism.
Excuse me? You need to wear a mask. Do you understand that? To come
You're
in this
violating
store?
My constitutional
Okay, well,
rights.
This is private property.
This private fucking property has food. I have a right to buy food without being forced to participate in a fake global false flag pandemic. There's no pandemic. You!
Okay, so I acknowledge some of that was hard to follow because we had to bleep out the swears, but it does end with him saying that he wants the employees of Publix to be mass arrested and executed for terrorism.
Now,
you're originally from Miami, correct?
Yeah, I'm from Miami. I know that Publix, and I get it. I get it, guy. The Publix subs are the best. They're better than Subway. They're better than Quiznos. They're the best, and I get it. You want your Publix subs, but yeah, I mean. He probably watches OANN. I don't know. what can I say? It's a crazy time we live in.
I love that you've been to that particular Publix.
Oh,
I've been
absolutely.
To a Publix in Florida, but I've not been to that particular
I think
one.
I'm like 90% sure that's the Publix in Brickell.
Oh, interesting. So look, what I want to throw out is that the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, which represents 1.3 million food and retail workers, says so far 72 U.S. food industry workers have died from that false flag fake pandemic, and nearly 3,000 have shown symptoms of the coronavirus. Those numbers are only going to grow, even if we wear our masks. People working at these supermarkets have been exposing themselves at a very high level, like far more than regular people. They've been asked to make a sacrifice that they are barely compensated for. Yeah. They don't deserve to be abused. And then look, beyond that, I've been trying to do my best to fight against misinformation around this from the very beginning. I have a feeling that guy probably does not watch the damage report. And look, he didn't attack them. He apparently wandered off. No arrests were made. But I am worried about every day I see a story of a guy who there was yesterday. A guy wiped his nose on an employee at a supermarket.
Jesus.
Because he'd been asked to leave. There was the guy in the San Diego supermarket who was wearing a KKK mask. Like, there are crazy people that are being misinformed and then sent out there to have a problem by the same people. Like, Fox is misinforming them and then promoting these protests saying the lockdowns are fake. Tucker Carlson saying there's no scientific reason to believe that the lockdowns mattered. Laura Ingraham saying there's no reason to socially distance and masks are unscientific. And the people who are going to suffer from that are mostly Fox viewers, but also the workers who come into contact with them.
The customer is always right is one of the more noxious phrases and ideas that has become sort of canon in the American religion, right? Mm-hmm. And it's this idea that in any sort of situation in which you are a customer, either at a supermarket or at a restaurant, that you are the dictator of that interaction and that the person in front of you is basically your slave to do whatever, you know, is anything you want. And it just creates this environment of no real solidarity, like what you're talking about. Like, this, you know, these supermarket workers are risking their lives for what, $16 an hour?
Maybe.
You know what I mean? Yeah, if they're lucky. And to see people just like so blatantly dismissive of them and hostile to them is absolutely dispiriting. I mean, it's just, I don't know what else to say. Like, it's just, yeah. It really is just incredibly sad.
I agree. And a couple of people in the comments are pointing out the security guard, I believe at a dollar store, that was killed for trying to get people to wear their masks. Was literally killed. And these are people who...
No, you know, again, it's like when you're starting to see, like what you're starting to see with Tucker Carlson and Fox and all these people sort of changing their tune a little bit on the coronavirus, starting to question the narrative and all that stuff. You know, like you can sort of track this perfectly with, oh my God, like we need these workers to be working. If not, like our bottom line is going to be affected.
Yeah.
Right. And if public health ever comes up against profit or the bottom line or the interests of the ruling class, mm-hmm. the thing that always wins out is the interests of the ruling class.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. And like there was like briefly the drive to reopen back around May 1st or whatever. Trump said, you know, we're going to reopen on Easter, and there was pushback and he actually backed down. And that bought us a couple of weeks, and then that's it. He doesn't care. He was on the news a couple days ago saying we're doing too much testing right now. Like we're doing less than half of the bare minimum of what experts say we need to be doing to reopen. And he says that that is a waste of testing. They've totally come around to the numbers don't matter. If another 70,000 die, it doesn't matter. Oh, and by the way, the numbers aren't real anyway. Right. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. They're being inflated. So you don't have to actually believe that people are dying at a rate of several thousand each year. He's moved on. He doesn't care anymore. His voters don't seem to care, even though a lot of them are dying. And I just wonder if a second spike happens, if another pandemic happens, if it comes back in the fall or the winter, why would we believe that they would take it more seriously then?
No, they would probably take it less seriously. I mean, they might do like some sort of targeted thing to protect certain wealthier areas and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. I don't see them doing this like lockdown ever again. I mean, the practical effects of the lockdown are similar to those of like a mass general strike, mm-hmm. you know, and it really is burning, like it really is affecting their bottom line. So it's like, it's almost like they accidentally inflicted a general strike on themselves, and they're seeing just how much that hurts, that hurts them. And so they're not going to do that again. There's no way they're going to do that again.
So we're going through this experience, and we have a lot of, not everyone obviously from that video, but we have a lot of people sort of publicly acknowledging these people who allow our country to function, that we don't care about, we don't pay them enough. So now people are starting to acknowledge some of these people who are actually essential. Although the government doesn't seem to care about the number of unemployed, the fact that they're not going to be able to pay rent. I think a lot of people are thinking about it. Do you think that there's any sort of medium or long-term effect of this that might nudge the country in the right sort of pro-worker direction?
I think yes, it's possible. It's not guaranteed. I do think that things are going to get a lot worse before that would happen. You know, this is the greatest economic crisis probably in the history of capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's probably going to be greater than the Great Depression from 1929 through the 30s. Mm-hmm. And the world that emerges on the other side of that is completely unpredictable. I mean, at least back then, you had very large labor unions and a real semblance of mass politics as a result. That does not exist today. Yeah. There is no vehicle for mass collective struggle. Labor unions are cowering and weak in the United States. So the political economy that emerges from such a profound economic crisis is going to be so different that it's going to be hard for it's hard for anyone to predict what's going to happen.
Yeah.
What is happening right now is that the ruling class understands that the house is burning and they need to loot the safe. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the bailout that was passed a few weeks ago with overwhelming bipartisan support and even barely a peep from the even dissident left in Congress and Senate is a fundamental reorganization of the American political economy. And it's going to have effects for years, even decades. And the only hope we have is some sort of regeneration of mass politics, of mass collective struggle. And it's hard to do that in a pandemic because you can't go outside, you can't meet with people, you can't organize in collective spaces. Yeah. And it's just hard to do that when there is no vibrant labor movement. It's the only weapon that has proven successful in history to affect any sort of real change, you know? And it's the only thing. There's literally been nothing else. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, I'm glad that you mentioned that bailout, because we do have to bear in mind that no matter what happens or doesn't happen, they already got those trillions of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
That is theirs. And one of the most corrupt people in the history of U.S. government has almost unilateral control to hand it out to whoever he wants. So that's a great setup. Maybe we'll get another $1,200 someday, but probably not. But they got trillions of dollars.
Yeah.
And so you point out the possible paths that this could go down. In a dark comedic sense, could it be any more perfect that just as the pandemic was starting to hit the U.S., we had two Democratic presidential nominees representing very different directions we could go in, and the system rushed to choose one that best case scenario brings us back to something like 6 years ago, rather than helping us weather this storm and correct the issues that were already in the system before COVID-19 was ever even heard of.
I think that is a incredibly rosy reading of a potential Biden presidency, because here's what's going to happen. Because this crisis is orders of magnitude larger than 2008.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And look at the backlash that was hoisted on the Obama presidency because of their sort of weak reaction to that crisis. Right.
Yeah.
And I suspect that a Biden administration wouldn't even be as aggressive as the Obama administration was in responding to 2008. So the nightmare scenario is that the economy is in a historic collapse. Okay. Look at the number of unemployed. I mean, there's 33 million people that filed for unemployment in 7 weeks. You know, these are unprecedented numbers. The nightmare scenario is that the Democrats win, and then they oversee the quote unquote recovery of such a scenario. And obviously it's going to be terrible. And
100% austerity.
100% austerity. Larry Summers is going to run the economy. You know what I mean? Like Michael Bloomberg is going to be the Secretary of Treasury. And it's going to be awful. It's going to be just another giant handout to the rich. And it's going to fuel another major right-wing backlash to that. You see what I mean? Like that's the nightmare scenario. And it's probably the likely scenario if Biden wins the presidency. So I don't think that there is any hope for a return to 6 years from that is gone. There is no returning. The economy is in such a collapse that there's no putting Humpty Dumpty back together again. There is only some sort of new thing that's going to come.
Yeah.
And the sort of coalescing around Biden from the Democratic Party, from Barack Obama and all the power players is like an incredible, like it's almost like a black pill moment, right? You know, like it's like they don't care. They don't care about any of this stuff other than enforcing their own status quo, their own privilege and their own power and control over the society.
When Ryan Grimm was on, we were talking about Perdue and Burr and Loeffler and the others who, like, as it was bearing down on us, they did whatever was necessary in terms of stocks to shore themselves up.
Oh yeah,
it feels like that. It's like it's like a political equivalent to dumping stock before the storm.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's looting the safe while the building burns. Yeah. You know, that's what it is, and then locking the door and keeping us all inside.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and it's amazing. Like we. Obviously, when Trump came in, they got another round of the tax cuts, and that was, you know, like $1.8 trillion or something like that. They got these trillions for businesses way easier, way faster, and I haven't heard anyone talk about it in weeks.
We talk about
the tax cuts sometimes. We don't talk about that.
It's amazing. The bailout bill will be like looked on 50 years from now, 100 years from now by historians as like this kind of just unprecedented fundamental restructuring of the largest economy in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I mean? Like it's just so breathtaking how quickly it happened, how quickly the system snapped into place.
The Patriot Act, but for business, basically.
Yes. We can't even our system is incapable of manufacturing something as simple as a freaking mask, you know, and they snap into place as soon as the ruling class needs a trillions dollar bailout.
Exactly.
It's absolutely breathtaking. You know, like this is why when you look back at history, the only means of collective struggle are this version of mass politics. And we don't have that now. We just don't have it. So we can't even get scraps. We can get the bare minimum of scraps, you know, just to like more or less keep us living, to keep the system going.
Yeah.
But there is no concessions to be wrought from the ruling class at this point. It's really a difficult time. Like, things are going to get a lot worse, I suspect. And
I don't know what concessions you need. You got your $1,200, man.
Yeah, just shut the hell up. Yeah.
If you got it. And yeah. Many of you probably didn't.
I haven't gotten it.
I didn't get anything either. Yeah. And people I know are still having trouble week after week after week getting unemployment for no reason. I am sure that you have seen the study that came out, the reporting of that study that came out just a few weeks ago, indicating that depending on where you get your news, even inside of the same news network, it could have a significant outcome on how you've weathered this pandemic that we're experiencing. It caused a lot of conversation online. It looks like some places might be getting sued as a result of it. And so I thought when I saw that study, I have got to talk to one of the individuals that put this together. And so we can now bring that to you live. We have PhD student from Harvard University, Akash Rao. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you on. For people who might not have seen the reporting, and the vast majority won't have actually seen the actual study, can you give a bit of an explanation of what it was exactly that you were investigating?
Sure. So as economists, we've been interested in the question of how information and the media affects behavior for a long time. And so economists have looked at questions like, how does information affect voting, violence and conflict, fertility decisions? And we think that pandemics are a particularly interesting setting to study the effects of misinformation, because the consequences of my behavior actually spill over to other people. So if I don't think that COVID is a threat and I don't wash my hands, I don't wear a face mask, or I don't practice social distancing, you know, I'm hurting not only myself, but those around me. And so any consequences of misinformation can really be magnified and have significant effects on behavior. And so, you know, that's why we studied misinformation broadly, and we zoomed in on Fox News for a couple of reasons. First, because Fox News is just by far the largest cable network in the U.S. It's around as big as CNN and MSNBC combined in terms of total viewership. So it's an important population to study. And then secondly, because viewers of Fox News are disproportionately elderly. So the median viewer age is around 65, which, you know, if we know from CDC, is precisely the population that's most at risk from the coronavirus. And so potentially misinformation on Fox News could have more effects on behavior or be more dangerous than misinformation on other networks. And then finally, the impetus for Fox News was that there was really striking variation on the network in how the anchors covered the coronavirus. So in particular, the two most popular shows on Fox News, which actually are the two most popular shows, the news or news opinion shows in the U.S., these two shows told very different stories about how serious the coronavirus was. So Tucker Carlson really said that it might be a serious threat from as early as late January, and he discussed it throughout February. Whereas Sean Hannity kind of downplayed its severity. He discussed it a little bit in late January, but he essentially ignored it throughout most of February. And even when he began talking about it, he said it was no worse than the common flu, that it was a partisan hoax to undermine the administration, et cetera. And so from our perspective as researchers, that sets up a really interesting opportunity to compare two populations that are ex ante pretty similar, you know, viewers of Tucker Carlson and viewers of Sean Hannity, and really zoom in on how the differing perspectives presented on these two shows might have influenced downstream health outcomes and behavior.
I want to jump in just for 1 second. So I'm curious, in terms of, you know, different demographic variables, so there is good evidence that shows that the, you know, average age, the geographic distribution of Tucker viewers versus Hannity viewers is pretty similar?
So it's relatively similar, certainly more so than if you compare viewers of Fox News as a whole to viewers of CNN or MSNBC.
Okay,
there are still differences between Tucker Carlson's viewers and Hannity's viewers. And so we go through a variety of procedures in our paper to correct for those differences and ensure that they're not driving our results.
Okay, and I'm glad that you acknowledge that, because I actually had to put out an article trying to explain to Sean Hannity once that his critique of a scientific study saying that it hadn't corrected for things, he didn't understand how that actually works. I'm glad that you do, especially with such important material. And so that sort of answers one of my follow-up questions, was going to be why you'd compare two shows on Fox as opposed to like a Tucker Carlson and a Rachel Maddow or something like that. But I am also interested that you have two sort of non-straight news-related shows, as opposed to having like a Chris Wallace and a Tucker Carlson, that you have two predominantly primetime opinion people.
Right.
And I'm assuming the audiences are far larger. So right. So I know that you did find that there was a difference, apparently, at county level in terms of number of cases and number of deaths of coronavirus. I'm curious, exactly what period did your analysis end at?
So in the version of the paper that's currently published, we're ending in early April. Okay. Since then, we've been able to extend our analysis, and so we're going to be releasing a new version of those results within the next week or two. That'll speak to effects until early May.
I mean, I gotta say, I can't wait to see that, because I've been curious. I really liked that you differentiated Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity, showed how they did take it differently, and they very much did. What I'm curious about is the late April and early May coverage, where. I know that Fox News is now taking it seriously, like that's their stance. But predominantly, in the last week or so, I've seen Tucker Carlson do multiple shows saying that there's no scientific basis for quarantines. You know, Laura Ingraham is obviously a slightly different person, but she says there's no scientific reason to believe that social distancing or wearing masks has any effect on the transmission of disease, which I found to be enlightening. Do you think that, I know that you probably don't want to spoil the paper ahead of time, do you think that you might start to see a little bit of a change in terms of Tucker Carlson's comparative advantage over Sean Hannity as you move into later April?
It's absolutely possible, because even as early as mid-March, we saw a convergence in how Hannity and Carlson covered the coronavirus. And so they really had strong differences throughout much of February, but, you know, throughout the early period of March, throughout the first week or so, Hannity really started taking it more seriously. And that was kind of in lockstep with Trump discussing it as a more serious threat. And so in the version of our paper that we released, we actually found that the differences in health outcomes around 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later also started to converge. And so it would absolutely not be a surprise if we saw that those differences shrank towards zero, because mm-hmm. these two anchors had become closer in how they covered the threat.
And, you know, I alluded to in the intro that I had heard, I believe Sean Hannity made a sort of vague threat against one of the outlets that wrote up, they referenced your paper. It wasn't predominantly about your paper, but they did reference it, and he had made a threat to sue. I don't know that he's actually pursued anything like that. Have you or your co-authors received any sort of pushback for the results that you found?
So Fox News did put out a statement essentially disputing our study, saying it was junk science and pointing to instances where Hannity had covered the coronavirus, essentially accusing us of cherry picking examples. And we don't think that's a fair criticism, essentially because we considered every single show that these two anchors had done. So we're not, you know, looking specifically at shows where Hannity ignored the coronavirus. We're looking at every single show between late January and late March. And so there's really no scope for cherry picking in that part of the analysis.
Okay, yeah, you weren't just picking like a random sampling of segments. You were looking at the entirety of the broadcasts.
Exactly.
And I'm curious, I know that you're going to be releasing an updated version of this. Are there any plans to, for instance, see what effect maybe, this would be pretty difficult, I suppose, but long term in terms of how quickly people go back into the reopened economy, how long they stick to social distancing recommendations or mask guidelines, anything like that more medium term?
It's absolutely an interesting question. So we don't yet have specific plans to look at that. But certainly the question of how persistent are these effects? You know, if I hear things repeatedly in February, do I still believe them in April, even in the face of information that contradicts it? Super interesting questions and questions that I would absolutely be interested in knowing the answer to.
And I only say this mainly because I miss a little bit being in academia myself. Have you considered at all? I know that John Oliver did a show where he talked about sort of the timeline of the hydroxychloroquine narrative, how he traced it actually back to a broadcast on Tucker Carlson's show. And not long after that, Donald Trump began talking about it more often. I don't know exactly how you would do this, but I would be curious to see, depending on how those hosts, how seriously they're taking it, if there's any sort of link a day or two later to Donald Trump's rhetoric about the pandemic. He has at various times seemed to take his cues from Fox and Friends and Sean Hannity and things like that. I don't know if that's possible, but just an idea.
Absolutely. No, it's super interesting. There have been some work in our field looking at how the media can actually impact political behavior. So, for example, a great paper for around a decade ago found that when the media isn't covering disaster relief efforts, the government spends less resources on those disaster relief efforts, presumably because they can't take credit. And so it's a super interesting question, this interplay of the media and political decisions. It's not one that we can really get at just given small sample sizes and given the situation, but it's absolutely very interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. And one president is about as small a sample size as you can imagine. Exactly. Well, anyway, I want to thank you for joining us on the show. It's fascinating work. Had a lot of fun talking with you, and I'll be looking to see the updated versions of this in the future.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.